Right, it's my pleasure to introduce Jan Westhoff from the Department of Philosophy, the University of Durham, who's going to tell us about categories in Madhyamaka.
Well, as you see with the last presentation, we were moving to the 21st century with presentation technology, and now we are back to the 80s, with OHP, probably an age nobody wants to go back to. So I apologize to those people who don't like bullet points, as you see on the handouts. There are plenty of bullet points. There's a handout going around somewhere with the slides. But unfortunately, the presentation technology of the 22nd century, which is probably direct mind-to-mind transference, is not yet available to me. So please bear with me with these slightly primitive 80s-style slides here. Okay, so what I want to talk about today is categories and Madhyamaka. Now, just as a brief sort of intro, when I talk about Madhyamaka, I'm primarily referring to those kinds of speakers which later in the development of the Tibetan traditions will come to be called Prasangika Madhyamaka. So this is generally the school which developed out of the commentaries by Chandrakirti. Now, I'm doing that not because of some sort of Gelugpa partisanship on my side, but rather because I think that it's with these authors that the issues about categorizations and the feasibility of the system of categories become particularly noticeable, and that the positions they espouse are particularly extreme. So I think this is where the really interesting questions are. So that's why I focus on these texts and these commentators. Okay, so let us begin actually by looking at two principles which at least some Madhyamaka authors assert, and which I think are quite relevant for their interpretation of how a system of categories could be interpreted in a Madhyamaka context. The first I've called the common sense principle, and the second I've called the no analysis principle. So the first, the common sense principle, claims that only ontological categories of common sense are to be accepted. So Chandrakirti points out at one point that, very famous, and often this passage is often quoted, and he says this: what is admitted in the world to exist, I too admit that to exist. And what is admitted in the world to be non-existent, I too admit that to be non-existent. Right, so this kind of position has two interesting consequences. So first of all, a statement made in the context of discussions of the Buddha's greatest teaching suitable to different kinds of disciples at different levels of spiritual progress. And it seems to be some sort of extreme conventionalism, because it seems to say that whatever ontological commitments the world makes, those are accepted for the purely pragmatic purpose of teaching the disciples and teaching those who hold their commitments. So, and it seems to be that for a thinker who holds that kind of commitment, so the common sense principle, there seems to be no place for the traditional philosophical enterprise of building an ontological theory. And by that I mean thinking about the most fundamental conceptual and linguistic approaches to the world and attempting to systematize them into a coherent theory, because it is quite likely that what we come up with is very different from what the world asserts. So there's one problem, is it seems to be a conflict with ontology as traditionally conceived. And secondly, there seems to be also a fairly strange conception of the notion of conventional truth here. Because samvritti satya, because that turns out to be basically with a kind of proof by conventional truth by popular consensus. And we seem to lose the ability to argue that the majority of people could ever be fundamentally wrong, since on the common sense account, it seems to be being thought so is what makes it so, or at least if sufficiently many people do the thinking. Okay, so that is one principle which seems to be present in Madhyamaka thought and which conflicts with the constructional system of ontological categories. The second is what I call the no-analysis principle. And the no-analysis principle, again, it's... You find that in Chandrakirti, when he says, one might ask, but why should it be worldly convention? Does this imply that it is differentiated from what is non-worldly convention? We reply, worldly convention rather posits things as they are, on a conventional level is to be understood here, and it does not engage in analysis. So So what's happening here is that this principle rejects the application of analysis to the systems of ontological categories licensed by the common sense principle in order to adopt one system over another system of categories and to add theoretical refinements to the systems one ends up adopting. Now, adopting the no-analysis principle in a sort of naive and unqualified manner entails that our conventional way of epistemic engagement with the world does not require us to go beyond what our senses tell us in order to arrive at some more fundamental level of knowledge about the world. Well, one example where you can see that coming into practice is actually when Chandrakirti talks about Nagarjuna's analysis of causation, and in the context of the commentary there he says, we're talking about Samvritti Satya, conventional truth again, the worldly person indeed, without starting to analyze whether it is from itself or from other or from both, understands only this much: from a cause comes an effect. The master here being Nagarjuna, also explains things in the same way. So here, I mean, there seems to be no room for a philosophically sophisticated theory of causation over and above pointing out what is conventionally accepted, namely that rice comes from rice, and barley comes from barley, and sheep comes from sheep, but not from cows, and so on. So Chandrakirti regards the analysis of ordinary notions as an attempt of arriving at an understanding of them which goes beyond ordinary usage as fundamentally mistaken. And it's also interesting as a sort of footnote to note that in the Tibetan doxographical tradition, we also find another term for Prasangika Madhyamika, which is Jikten Jagtepa, which is those who follow or adhere to the Jikten Jagtepa, the worldly conventions. And that, of course, goes fairly closely with accepting what the world says and without actually scrutinizing that by philosophical analysis. Now, so at this position, it all seems to look philosophically fairly dire, because if we can do is attempt to take general opinion uncritically at face value, then there is not much philosophy to be done. Now, fortunately, not all Buddhist thinkers actually saw matters in that way. So here's an interesting comment on this problem by Kamala Shila. Here's what he says: suppose it were thought, why should we analyze it when the production of sprouts and the like being conditioned by seeds and the like is just simply acknowledged by everyone from cowherds up? So cowherds actually become very important here, as you'll read later on, this is the man of the Clapham omnibus, this is a cowherd here. So judicious people should not analyze in order to ascertain the nature of entities, because it would follow that there would be no end to such an analysis. And it would follow that it would not be judicious. Okay, so that's the supposed thought. Now, this is not right. Concerning this, consider this example. It is acknowledged that perishing is something that has a cause, and though people acknowledge that matter and the like are external objects, this can be invalidated by means of reliable cognition, if it is subjected to analysis. In the same way here too, what people acknowledge could also turn out to be false, and hence one really has to analyze it. Okay, so we realize here the idea that none of the common sense principle or the no analysis principle can be taken really at face value, according to Kamala Shila, because sometimes people are just wrong, and then we analyze and then we realize that they are. But the question is, how do we find out that is actually the majority of people getting it wrong, and what's our justification there? So one way of doing so is by determining that they've based their opinion on unreliable epistemic instruments. Now, this is interestingly spelled out by a much later source, actually a Tibetan source, namely Tsongkhapa, writes on this issue also, of course, having Chandrakirti in mind, and he says, the internal impairments of the sense faculties are such things as floaters, jaundice, and such things as hallucinogenic drugs one has consumed. The external impairments of the sense faculties are such things as mirrors, the echoing of sounds in a cave, and the rays of the autumn sun falling on such things as white sand. Sorry, it looks yellow or red. The impairments of the mental faculty are, in addition to these, such things as erroneous philosophical views, very interesting that one, fallacious arguments and sleep on one level. So Tsongkhapa continues, taking conventional objects grasped by such unimpaired and impaired cognitive faculties to be real or unreal, respectively, merely confirms the ordinary cognitive practice. This is because they actually exist as they appear or do not, according to whether or not they are undermined by ordinary cognition. But this distinction is not drawn from the perspective of the Arya, so from the perspective of the enlightened mind. This is because just as such things as reflections do not exist as they appear, such things as blue that appear to exist through their own characteristics to those who are afflicted by ignorance do not actually exist as they appear. So what's the point being made here? So the point is that there might be a belief which a group of people may hold, for example, that there's a snake in front of them in a dark room, which can be refuted by conventional means, that is, by demonstrating that the epistemic instruments used for making those cognitions are in some way impaired, for example, by lack of light or something like that, and by replacing them by faculties that are not so impaired. It is therefore possible to draw a distinction between what is real, maybe a real snake and a snake was just a rope, or water in a mirage and real water, at the level of conventional reality. So this does not change the fact, however, that all these things I've talked about have the same degree of unreality at the ultimate level, according to the Buddhist analysis, right? Because they all lack intrinsic existence, they all lack svabhava. Right, so if we take these two quotations into account, then it seems to be that the no analysis principle has to be modified to allow the Madhyamaka to carry out some sort of analysis, as long as he does not stray too far from what's admitted by the world and is therefore licensed by the common sense principle. So you can't just cook up something philosophically sophisticated and then say that's the real deal, because it all has to be somehow grounded in what the cowherds think. Or at least that's the kind of drive you get from these two principles. So the Madhyamaka is not obliged to concur with any belief the folk happens to hold, but only with those which are the result of applying the right kinds of epistemic instruments in the right manner, so they're not impaired, and given that the impairment, at least according to Tsongkhapa, includes such things as wrong theoretical views, you think this is a very flexible position then. What they are limited to is accepting what the folk holds, as long as that is actually based on the right kind of epistemic instruments. So beliefs which do not pass the text, they are dismissed as deficient. Right, but now the question is that actually good enough if we want to do an ontological analysis and want to come up with a system of categories? Unfortunately, it's not, because when Chandrakirti points out that worldly convention does not engage in analysis, he intends this to extend to ultimate analysis as well. So again, Tsongkhapa says here, the master, in this case his master is Chandrakirti, repeatedly said that these conventionalities, such as shape and sound, do exist. However, they are not in the least established by ultimate analysis, that is, by reasoning that analyzes whether they have svabhava, intrinsic nature, or not. Thus, the scrutiny of reason is not applied to them. So, even if Chandrakirti rejects intricate theories of conventional phenomena full of philosophical commitments, he does not reject the usefulness of commonly accepted conventional concepts such as shape and sound. At the level of conventional truth, medium-sized dry goods such as tables and chairs are known to exist, and hallucinations and mirages are known not to exist. At the level of ultimate truth, however, there are no tables and no chairs and no mirages either. This is because what exists ultimately is established by ultimate analysis, and which is an analysis trying to find an object's substantial or intrinsic nature. So ultimate analysis in this Madhyamaka parlance is always an analytical approach which tries to find out whether the object has svabhava. And of course, unsurprisingly, the answer is always no. So since the Madhyamaka argues there is no svabhava, either at the conventional level or at the ultimate level, actually, at least if you're a prasangika, then tables and chairs and stuff like that does not exist from the perspective of ultimate truth. Now, the important point in the context of the present discussion is, of course, that the categorical analysis ontologists are interested in is a variety of ultimate analysis. And the truth it's likely to establish would count as ultimate truth. So, of course, that doesn't apply to any sort of categorical analysis, right? So because there are some kind of categories which are not ontological categories. So if we classify cutlery into spoons and forks and knives and so on, that's a categorical analysis, but not the kind of categorical analysis ontologists are interested in. Okay, so we have to pick the right kind of ontological analysis. So if we classify an object on in terms of an ontological category it belongs to, assuming we actually have a clear understanding of what an ontological category is, so take as an example, say a material object, a specially extended object, or mental object, something like that, then this is to be understood as based on the object's intrinsic nature, some property it has in and through itself, something the object could not even lose in any conceivable circumstances, right? So that's distinguished from, say, the way we classify a spoon, right? We classify something as a spoon because it resembles certain other kinds of eating instruments which are used in a certain kind of context by 21st century humans, right? But we don't actually think there's something in a piece of metal which makes it a spoon in and independent of all these, of this context in which it's used. However, with ontological categories, it's not the case. We think it's actually, if we classify something as ontologically blah, then we're actually getting to the bottom of the thing. So I mean, try imagining a world in which, say, a spoon or the counterpart of that spoon actually belongs to a different ontological category to the one it doesn't belong to, but belongs to here. So assume we've got a spoon, and in this world we classify it as a material object. Now assume that in another world there's either the same spoon or the counterpart of that spoon, but actually belongs to a different category. So say it's in another world it's a number, say, or thought. Now that's really weird, and we'd even say that's hard to make sense of. And it is hard to make sense of because we don't think ontological category membership can be flexible in that way, or at least that's the majority way in which people understand the meaning of ontological category. So for this reason, the theory of categories in any philosophically important sense is not just a conventionally approved classificatory device, so that's when we talk about cutlery, but it's a theory of characteristics objects have by their intrinsic nature, and of course that means by svabhava. However, since the Madhyamaka denies the existence of any such thing as svabhava, such a theory must necessarily be vacuous. So it seems to be that for Madhyamaka there can't really be any theory of categories. Furthermore, it cannot be any theory, this theory of categories can't be any theory which is part of the conventional analysis of phenomena, since it investigates characteristics which are supposed to be intrinsic. Therefore, it appears that despite the fact that conventional analysis can very well save us from the strict reading of the common sense principle and the no analysis principle, which Tom Tillemans calls the dismal view of having to accept whatever a sufficiently large group of people believes as a conventional truth, a theory of ontological categories is incompatible with the main claim of Madhyamaka thought, namely that there is no svabhava. Okay, so this is basically what it looks like on the tin. But if you actually open the tin, you realize that it looks very different on the inside. And there are actually a lot of categories floating around. Now the question is how that all fits together. So what's happening is if we look at Madhyamaka texts, we realize that despite the advocacy of an ordinary Calmet-compatible view of the world, Madhyamakas employ fairly sophisticated categorical schemas to make their points. And this seems to go well past anything one would expect something like a common sense principle to license. It's far too sophisticated to that. And in fact, there are three kinds of contexts where... there are two kinds of categorical schemes which I want to talk about today, which Madhyamaka uses in their arguments. One is a set of grammatical categories, and the second is the categories of the Abhidharma. And then finally, I'm going to have a look at the Madhyamaka interaction with the system of categories, which we find in Nyaya text, and see what they say about that, and how their positions on all these matters, were they actually compatible with both the common sense principle and the no analysis principle. Now, talking about the first example, about the use of grammatical categories, a very clear example is Chandrakirti's using the Garaka theory from traditional Indian grammar in order to explain some of Nagarjuna's arguments in the second chapter of the Karikas, which is all about motion and change. Now, the Karaka theory, just very briefly, is a theory that deals with the various functions objects described by the parts of a sentence can occupy relative to the action described by the verb. So, for example, being the agent and being the recipient and being the instrument and so forth. And then these are marked by the different Sanskrit cases. So it's a theory which tells you semantically what's going on when you use a certain case. Now, in the commentary, Chandrakirti notes that the word gamyate is moved, requires a term denoting an agent, which is the mover. However, Nagarjuna observes in verse 5 of that very chapter that a moving mover has to be conceived as endowed with two kinds of motion properties, a constitutive property by which it is a moving object, and an instantiated one by which it has the property of moving. So let me just give you briefly a background to this idea. So usually when we talk about objects, we differentiate between the constitutive property and the instantiating property insofar as the constitutive property is sort of the condensation nucleus of the property. So say, take an example, you've got something like a green heavy square. Then if you say it's a green heavy square, then you would regard the nominalized part, namely the square bit here, as the constitutive property in which the two instantiating properties, namely greenness and heaviness, in here, right? So we've got one individual on a sort of standard analysis of two properties, right? So one constitutive property, it's the squareness, and the two instantiated properties, namely the greenness and the heaviness. Now, it's of course interesting to note, and I think this is something Nagarjuna exploits in these arguments here, is the fact that this is highly perspectival, because instead of speaking of a green heavy square, you can also speak of a green object which is heavy and square shaped, or a heavy object which is green and square shaped. These different formulations are supposed to suggest that you conceptualize of the object in different ways. I mean, now you regard the heaviness or the greenness as the constitutive properties, and the other two properties as the instantiating. So it seems to be fairly flexible here how we construe the ontology of that. Now, what does that have all to do with motion? Well, Nagarjuna argues that if you've got a statement like "the mover moves," then it is difficult to see how you can actually interpret this in terms of this differentiation between instantiating property and constitutive property, because here there's only one property, there's only the moving, so we would have to split this up into one property, which actually which is the moving object, and the other one which is instantiated by that. But that seems slightly bizarre from an ontological level, because we only have one property, we only have the moving here, but suddenly we have to say, well, there are actually two properties here. So that's the argument which is happening here in the fifth verse. Now, so what happens in the commentary is that Chandrakirti observes that he then looks at classical grammatical accounts of how to actually interpret the karaka. So the karaka agent is of course the role which is important here, and he points out that the karaka is best to be understood not as a substance, not as a dravya, but as a power, as shakti. So the difficulties with regarding a karaka as a substance is apparent, because after all, the same object can fulfill different semantic functions, right? So it can be the agent of an action, but it could also be the object of an action. Now, if that role would be something which the object had substantially, then we would think that can never change. But if we actually want to say that the same object can be in different semantic contexts, then it's better not something which the object has intrinsically by its very nature. So we shouldn't conceive of it as a substance, we should conceive of it as a power it has, given that this power has been probably actualized in certain circumstances. Right, so what is happening now is that, and of course the argument continues, now, because then Chandrakirti adds, well, if you interpret it in this way, then you have to say, okay, so then if you say the mover moves, they're actually not two different substances, because there would have to be an agent for each of these two motions, so they're not two different substances here, but just two different powers, and then the it get, and then the question is whether that you can actually make that intelligible, and then it goes through a number of further epicycles, which Anarchy says that doesn't work either, because then you've got problems of how you actually tell the one Shakti, the one power, from another one, and so on and so on. But what is important for the present context here is not actually where exactly this Madhyamika argument is going here, and whether it's successful in the end, but the question is actually the type of argument we find here, because we are obviously dealing with an example of ultimate analysis here. What is at issue whether objects have an intrinsic nature, it's the bhava. Nevertheless, in this framework which Chandrakirti uses in order to explain Nagarjuna's verses, he uses part of a highly intricate system of traditional Indian grammatical analysis. So while it is a set of conventional truth, presumably grammatical analysis, it is certainly not at the level of cowherd compatible truths such as fire is hot and rice comes from rice and that kind of stuff. So we would also not set up questions about this about karaka theories, or for example the question whether karaka is actually a substance or a power, by trying to determine what is emitted by the world, right? So this is like sort of trying to solve philosophical questions by taking the senses, right? Usually you realize if you ask the question you are interested in to the man in the omnibus, they would have no idea what the question means, right? So to that extent, it is unlikely to really go very well as an endorsement of the principle of the common sense. So we should also know the piece of grammatical theory that the piece of grammatical theory we are talking about here is one which involves a substantial amount of ontological theorizing, namely a classification of different kinds of relata of verbs and analysis of these in terms of other ontological categories such as substances and powers. So the use of karaka theory therefore seems to suggest that Madhyamika arguments can and do employ sophisticated systems of conventional truth for the purpose of ultimate analysis. And here you see the tension with the official party line I gave you on the first slide, where you say, well, we do what the cowherd, we accept only what the cowherds say, and we don't analyze, right? Here it seems to be that by Chandrakirti himself, we get quite a lot of analysis, and actually of a very complicated kind. Okay, so this is surprising fact number one. Now, what is surprising fact number two? And this is concerns Madhyamika and the categories of the Abhidharma. Now, it's philosophically, we can regard the whole Madhyamika enterprise, I think, as a direct reaction to the philosophical position of theory set out in the Abhidharma ontology. So, a particularly clear example we can find, for example, in one of Nagarjuna's hymns, Lokatitasdava, where he goes through a variety of ontological categories familiar from Abhidharmic analysis, so the five skandhas and the four great elements and agent and action and characteristic and characterized and so on, in order to argue that each of these lacks for svabhava. So if you know the extended way which Nagarjuna sets up his argument, you get an idea of how that works. So for example, there Nagarjuna says, addressing the Buddha, "You are convinced that apart from the mere skandhas, no sentient being exists, and yet, great sage, you surrender great pains for the sake of sentient beings. O intelligent one, you declare to the intelligent one that the skandhas are like a dream, like an illusion, like a city of Gandharas," and so on. So the realization of the illusion-like nature of the skandhas, and what that means is, of course, the emptiness, the absence of svabhava, is achieved on the basis of splitting up the person into five groups according to the theory of persons developed in the Abhidharma. So we've got this hymn and a variety of similar texts, for example, like the Heart Sutra or Nagarjuna's Pratityasamutpada Hridaya Karika, make it clear that a grasp of the categories of the Abhidharma constitutes a precondition for the realization of emptiness. These have to be understood first before emptiness can be realized. Now, this is why the Heart Sutra, for example, Avalokiteshvara speaking, points out that whoever wishes to practice the conduct within the profound perfection of wisdom should make the following observation. He probably sees the five skandhas, and he probably sees them to be empty. Now, what is interesting about this is that according to all these texts, and they're all fairly basic and fundamental texts, is that according to these texts, the Buddhist path, therefore, does not start with some sort of theory-free or unsophisticated conventionalities of the ordinary man on the street, and then goes to a direct conceptualization or realization of emptiness, as the common sense principle would lead one to think. You would think, okay, if it's set up like that, you say, okay, you start with the idea you have in any case, or with a kind of sort of consensus which you find amongst human beings, and then you analyze that, and then you realize emptiness. But that's actually not what you see in these texts. What's happening here is that the starting point is a rather intricate analytical framework that Abhidharma has projected into the world. And in this case, the theory of the five skandhas, because that breaks up what is commonly seen as the person. Now, similarly, the analysis in Nagarjuna's Karikas doesn't start from the basis of an unsophisticated set of conventions in order to arrive at a theory of emptiness by analyzing these conventions. It rather speaks to someone familiar with the highly complex framework of Abhidharma categories. And in order to follow the arguments Nagarjuna makes, it's necessary to have a thorough acquaintance with the system of Abhidharma in order to use it as a stepping stone in order to proceed to an understanding of emptiness. Right, so now there's an obvious counter-argument against what I've just said. And that's just saying, well, that's all very true, they use the categories of the Abhidharma, but in fact, this is just a cultural accident. I mean, these are just the texts Nagarjuna was arguing against. And if you actually understand how the Madhyamaka method works, then you will say, well, any category or framework is as good as any other, right? So you just start by, you just take your favorite framework, which people believe in, and then it'll generally be something which contains Svabhava at some point, and then you run the Madhyamaka analysis, and then you realize there's no Svabhava. And this is, for example, a position which has also been pushed by Mark Sideritz in a couple of texts when he argues, which is actually a very good point, I think, that there is no master argument for emptiness. So there's not like Berkeley's argument for idealism, there's nothing like that in Madhyamaka. And what's the reason for that? Well, in fact, there is a variety of reasons for this, but they're all actually bound up with the Madhyamaka understanding of phenomena, because they argue that there is nothing which is by Svabhava a means of knowledge, right? So what in order to arrive at the truth of emptiness, what you have to do is you have to take the system you work with and analyze to see whether that has Svabhava, and then work through Madhyamaka-style arguments in seeing that it lacks Svabhava. Now, but in order to do that, you can only do that in a reactive fashion according to the system which is presented to you, right? And that varies depending on who the opponent is. And for that reason, there can be a master argument, because you don't know what kind of cookie systems people come up with. So that's the bottom line here. Okay, well, that is all. I mean, the idea is here that any category of framework is as good as any other one as a starting point for Madhyamaka analysis. Since all the frameworks are similarly mistaken from ultimate perspective, in any case, we might as well just start anywhere you want. Okay, well, I think it's a sort of neat interpretative move, but I'm not quite sure. I've got a problem with that, because I don't see how that actually fits in with a lot of the discussion is when the Madhyamikas start interacting with the Nyaya system of categories. That actually brings me to the last point of what I want to talk about today. Now, in two passages on this one, on the next slide, I'm talking about from a text called the Vaidarya Prakarana, which is a fascinating text in which Nagarjuna tries to do a sort of blow-by-blow destruction of all the 16 Nyaya categories. Now, it is a fascinating text. It's also extremely hard to understand what's going on there. By what's going on there, it's extremely hard to understand how some of the arguments work. Of course, one of the difficulties is that it's not actually preserved in Sanskrit, but only in Tibetan translation, and particularly with this material, that doesn't really help. So so I'm only looking at two passages here, and I think I've got a sort of clear understanding of what's going on here, but with the entire text, I must say, there are really many of these refutations of the categories are extremely obscure. So so the first passage here I would like to examine, because in verse 68, and considers the category of argumentative quibbles, chala. These constitute a kind of fallacious response made by reinterpreting the meaning of one of the discussion's key term. Right, now in the secondary literature we get a nice example for what such an argumentative quibble could be like. So one example is that somebody denying that a boy has a new blanket, Nava Kambala, but arguing that he has only one blanket on the basis of reading Nava Kambala is meaning having nine blankets. So a reply based on a quibble can never be a successful move in an argument, independent of whether the point the quibbler raises is in fact true. This is because the quibbler changes the topic of debate, even if, as a matter of fact, the boy only has one blanket. This does not have any relevance for deciding whether the blanket is new or old. Okay, now let us discuss the passage in question. And given that this is actually quite an obscure passage, too, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through it sort of blow by blow and then give a little bit of commentary to see what's going on here. So perhaps I can actually sort of cover this so we can see where we are. So let's see. Okay, so first of all, this is the opponent speaking, right? It is objected, even though according to you, all have been asserted as categories, and they do not exist ultimately. So what's going on here is that the opponent says there is therefore the fault of Chala in the present debate between the Nyaya and Nagarjuna, because Nagarjuna and his opponent mean different things when they speak about categories. The Nyayika thinks they are fundamentally real things, and the Madhyamika thinks that they have a merely conventional reality. But then such a discussion seems to be as pointless as, say, one about the causes for the collapse of a bank, where one party thinks about a financial institution and the other one thinks about a riverbank, right? So it's actually they're talking at cross purposes. So there's the opponent says, okay, Nagarjuna, because there is a chala here, a quibble, there's no dispute between the two of us. Okay, so to this it is to be replied, That is not the case, because there would be this consequence for all replies. So what Nagarjuna is saying here, I think, is that if this really was a problem, then there would never be any discussion, philosophical or otherwise, where two parties do not agree on the meaning of all the terms. But if agreement is to be presupposed, depending on how comprehensive we take the meaning of a term to be, for example, whether it includes in it whether the term is instantiated or not, then it would be unclear why we would want to have a discussion in the first place. Because if we agree on all the features of X, including whether or not X exists, then there's very little to talk about. Okay, and then now we come to the crucial passage, actually, which is saying, it is not like that, because whatever I addressed in a reply, all those are meant precisely as categories. Okay, so this is a good point. Because Nagarjuna's criticism of the Nyaya categories here does not concern their ontological status, that is, the fact that the Nyayika believe them to be ultimate existence, while the Madhyamika only grants them conventional existence. Nagarjuna disputes the status of Nyaya categories on the conventional level, that is, add a system which describes a satisfactory systematization of things which are in the world independent of any concerns about their ultimate nature. Why is that? All disputants, by agreeing, would undeniably impair their own assertions. If the two disputants agree that the concept they debated about is not one but rather two distinct concepts, then their respective assumptions of having refuted the opinions of the other would be fallacious. All they have refuted is a straw man, since both have been talking about different concepts. Therefore, what is said in a reply, is it not reasonable rather than a fallacy? If the same concept is talked about, Nagarjuna's refutations have to be regarded as successful unless they can be criticized on other grounds than that of Chala. Otherwise, if one does not assert this principle, then there is no fallacy. And if one does not assume that there are two distinct terms at issue here, then there is no risk of a fallacy of talking past each other in the first place. Now, what is interesting about this fairly dense passage is that Nagarjuna's observation is that his criticism of the Nyaya categories is not a general one. So he's not arguing that they mistakenly superimpose Svabhava into things which really lack them, and that therefore their system is unsatisfactory from the perspective of ultimate truth. Nagarjuna criticizes them from the perspective of conventional truths, that is, by arguing that the difficulties already arise at the level of producing a categorical theory of the world, not just when the resulting theory is interpreted in a particular way. This is therefore seems to be to constitute a violation of the no analysis principle, which rejects analysis at the conventional level, right? So what's interesting about this passage is that Nagarjuna doesn't just criticize Nyaya system by the sort of at the base level by saying, okay, I don't even share the assumptions they make, and therefore everything they build on that is not really relevant for Madhyamika. No, because the engagement here gets a lot more sophisticated, because he actually tries to, well, he's actually successful, that's a different question, especially regarding the very obscure nature of his text. But at least what the aim of the game is to refute the Nyaya categories at the level of conventional reality. Okay, so that was the first passage I wanted to show you here. And now we come to the second one, and then we are nearly there. Okay, so this is Vaidalya Prakarana number 62 now. And this occurs at the end of his discussion of inconclusive reasons. Now, Nagarjuna here argues against the possibility of the Nayayika's reason having any argumentative force, since the objects these reasons refer to are momentary, only last for an instant. Now, the difficulty Nagarjuna seems to have in mind here is that argumentative processes are spread out in time, whereas the objects are not, so they come and go out of existence at an instant. Now, as soon as the reason has established anything about the object has already passed away, as a result of which central terms in the statement of the conclusion won't refer anymore. So basically, the argumentative inference is too slow to keep up with the world, right? So that's the argument here. Now, in the present account, I'm not primarily interested in whether that's a good argument or what the Nayayika can reply to that. But what I'm interested in is the presupposition of this argument. And because Nagarjuna's argument here rests on a premise which is universally accepted by Buddhists from the Abhidharma on, namely that of universal momentariness of things. So universal momentariness, however, is a conventional truth, and it would be hard to argue that it was one which was compatible with the common sense principle, which was sort of admitted by the world from the cowherds up. There seem to be at least some cases in which the Madhyamika criticizes Nyaya arguments for conventional reasons, pitching two statements at the level of conventional truth against each other, one of which, namely that of universal momentariness, is regarded as superior to another one, namely that of temporally spread out, temporally thick objects. Right? And that seems to go against the idea that the Madhyamika actually has any sophisticated analysis of conventional truth, apart from what the cowherd thinks that rice comes from rice and so on, because saying that everything only lasts for an instant certainly isn't a position on that very level. Now, not only do we find that the Madhyamikas use analytical tools in order to assess different systems of categories and to decide which ones are actually the right ones, there's also a marked difference to be observed in the way in which they deal with the categorical systems of the Abhidharma, which is sort of the home turf, because that's still a Buddhist system, and those of those of Nyaya. Whereas the former are regarded as acceptable as long as one does not take them ontologically seriously, that is, regard them as obtaining on the level of ultimate truth, the latter are deficient even at the level of conventional truth. Now, Chandrakirti, again, explicitly warns against incorporating such notions into one's own system. So it says, it's not logically acceptable, yukti vidura, it's not logically acceptable to accept things postulated by the heretics, which are contrary to reason. He also points out the conventional falsity of non-Buddhist systems, with a specific reference actually to the Samkhya theory. And he says this is from the Madhyamaka Vatara, like the intrinsic nature imputed by the heretic, completely carried away by the sleep of ignorance, what is imputed on illusions, mirages, and so on, those also do not exist from a worldly perspective. That's the important point. From a worldly perspective, they don't exist. Now, the auto-commentary. These heretics desire to enter into reality and do not grasp the things which are unmistaken and certainly identified, known by all up to ignorant people, cowherds, women, and so on, arising cessation, and so on. You see, this is not a very PC text. So they desire for excellence, so the cowherds and so on, they desire for excellence, but are like one climbing up a tree who, not having taken hold of the first branch, does not grasp the second. He falls immediately into the abyss of wrong views. Apart from perceiving the true truth, there will be no obtaining of the result, and the result is, of course, liberation. Therefore, their imputations, the three gunas, and so on, are certainly non-existent according to worldly convention. Now, that's the central bit here. Their non-existence according to worldly conventions. So, this passage appears to be a clear endorsement of the common sense principle. Chandrakirti's main worry with the Samkhyas and related heretic approaches is that they postulate metaphysical systems which are not compatible with the theories of conventional truth generally admitted by the world. So in constructing a metaphysical theory, it's necessary to base oneself on the truth allowed by the common sense principle, namely as commonly accepted by the world. That's the first branch of the tree. And in order to reach the higher branches of absolute truth, a level which is coherent with that world is to be required, right? So in order to get up the tree, you have to grasp the first branch, and the first branch is what the coward thinks. And then, of course, it's interesting to see what the second branches are, but unfortunately it doesn't elaborate on that one. So in the context of this very critical attitude towards non-Buddhist philosophical systems, it might strike us as surprising that Chandrakirti actually accepts the Nyaya quartet of epistemic instruments, the pramanas, something which is rejected by Nagarjuna in the Vigahadhyavartani and also by Vaidaryapakarana. But there mightn't be that much of a difficulty if we keep two things in mind. First of all, the Nyaya quartet might be conceived of, that's probably what Chandrakirti does, might be conceived of without the Vaisheshika metaphysics grafted onto it. So to this extent, Chandrakirti can regard it as theoretically useful device without a great deal of philosophical implications, or at least philosophical implication when it comes to Svabhava. Secondly, we should note that the property of the Nyaya quartet rejected by Nagarjuna is their fundamental status, the existence of Svabhava of these instruments, while what Chandrakirti affirms is their conventional existence, the fact that they are pragmatically useful, that we actually use them in reasoning, not that they have any special ontological status. So to this extent, the Madhyamika view of the categorical systems of Nyaya and Abhidhamma is similar. They're admissible on the conventional level as long as one does not take them too seriously at the ultimate level. Of course, taking them seriously means something different in the different cases. Taking the Abhidharma ontologically seriously means claiming that they do not, in turn, depend on other things for their existence. Taking the epistemic instrument of the Nyaya seriously means assuming that they have the nature of instruments independent of epistemic objects. So I think it would be mistaken to assume that the Buddhist authors simply favor the categorical system of the Abhidharma because, unlike that of Nyaya, it's formed an established part of the Buddhist doctrine. I think such partisanship is not supported by what the authors actually say, because they do not say that the Nyaya categories are deficient because the Buddha didn't state them. So it's not because they are not the words of the Buddha that's the problem. From a Madhyamika perspective, there are in fact good systematic reasons for favoring the Abhidharma framework. So apart from cases where Nyaya frameworks clashes with important Buddhist theses about the nature of conventional truth, for example, I've talked earlier about the stuff with universal momentariness, the primary reason is that the fact that non-Buddhist systems of categories are generally built around the notion of a substantial self. For example, in Nyaya, got the idea that cognition is buddhi is a property of Atman, and of course the Madhyamika will have none of that. But because they don't even think that exists conventionally, at least the Prasangikas don't exist, that even exists conventionally. As such, they're unable to adopt a system of categories which at various points appeals to objects they regard as non-existence. Okay, you'll be relieved to hear we are nearly there. That's now the conclusions of all of this, a couple of points. So I hope that the preceding discussion has shown that the Madhyamika view of conventional truth cannot be that of unreflected intuitions held by everybody from countless up. The Madhyamika discussion employs sophisticated philosophical systems of categories, such as those of traditional Indian grammar and Abhidharma, in the exposition of its arguments. Not all systems of categories are deemed equally suitable. For example, the Nyaya set is regarded as unsatisfactory, at least in Nagarjuna's analysis. Now, how are we to understand, finally, the conception of Madhyamika, as Madhyamika's conception of categories? It's evident that they cannot be regarded as ultimately true theories. Their use must be merely transactional. That the Madhyamikas ascribe a merely pragmatic use to systems of categories fits well with the fact that, unlike other schools of Buddhist thought, they never developed such a system of their own, but rather utilized those already in existence. Due to the specific philosophical view of Madhyamika, it's not possible, however, to use such a system off the shelf, as it were, without further qualification. The system in question has to be rephrased in such a way that it does not clash with the most fundamental assumption of Madhyamika thought, that of the absence of Svabhava. When the Madhyamika speaks of Abhidharma categories, such as the five skandhas, the four great elements, and so on, he's in fact referring to a suitably modified Abhidharma from which the claim that these are substantially existent objects, the dharmas which exist javyasat, as a primary existence, not just a secondary existence, has been removed. So it may therefore be plausible to assume that when the Madhyamika deliberates between different systems of categories at the conventional level, he's considering two main criteria, A, general philosophical usefulness, and B, the extent to which a system can be made Svoboda-free. This allows him to rank such system and provides criteria to choose between systems, none of which have any claim for truth at the absolute level, right? All wrong at the absolute level. It's evident that there is no fundamental tension between the Madhyamika enterprise and the construction of systems of categories as such. The Madhyamika is able to use any such system for putting forth its arguments as long as it can be made to work without the assumption that the categories in play constitute necessary and intrinsic properties of the object, of the objects categorized, and therefore that is would conflict with the central Madhyamika point it's trying to prove at the most fundamental level. Okay, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that fascinating and subtle presentation. It shows once again the facility of the two truths doctrine, that you can have your categories and throw them out at the same time.
Well, that's the beauty of it all, right?
So great.
Yeah.
I wonder if it might be useful for your presentation to make very clear what counts as conventional analysis and what counts as ultimate analysis. Because in Tsongkhapa's commentary on the Chandrakirti in various places, he's saying it's no problem using conventional analysis. Just to make more clear. When you say analysis, that it needs to be specified.
Well, what Tsongkhapa, of course, means when he classifies something as ultimate analysis is the kind of analysis which investigates something, whether something exists by svabhava, right? So, that's the defining trait for him. Now, I think we can usefully extrapolate that to other kinds of discussion and say, for example, as I try to argue that. When ontologists ask about systems of categories, what they're interested in usually is a question of ultimate analysis, right? Because they use the term svabhava, because what they are after is sufficiently similar to the svabhava Tsongkhapa rejects, right? So to that extent, I think it's there's a sufficient resemblance there. I'm not quite sure to which extent we actually could spell that out any more than saying ultimate analysis has a certain goal, right? Because that's it's a sort of teleological interpretation which Tsongkhapa gives. But otherwise, I mean, in terms of argumentative techniques and assumption and so on, this is all fairly flexible as far as I see.
I think that conventional reality can be, according to Tsongkhapa, can be subjected to conventional analysis. That's no problem.
Oh, yeah, that's fine,
but,
of course, yeah.
You know, and I think the conventional reality, it isn't just a matter of what is, there are many levels of conventional reality.
Mm.
So not just everything that is acceptable to the calibre, but even mathematicians talking about the nature of number and so on, that would be conventional reality as well.
Oh sure. You're completely right. As I try to say, if Tsongkhapa doesn't make these the same extreme statements as Chandrakirti does, even though of course he regards himself to be 110% in line with what Chandrakirti intends. But for him, conventional analysis can actually be fairly sophisticated and can incorporate very sophisticated theories. And reading Chandrakirti, it's that is not so clear when you get statements like, well, rise comes from rise, and that's the end of biology, right? So I mean, that doesn't get you very far. But certainly according to the way Tsongkhapa reads Chandrakirti, there's more to conventional reality than just that.
Gavin and Lance.
Sorry.
In my view, the Vajjanaka position leads us into silence and we can't say anything about the world. But that's not my question. My question is, given the Vajjanaka position, how can we distinguish? It's still unclear in my mind how we can distinguish between different degrees or different levels of conventional reality or conventional truth, given the uncompromising nature of the Vajjanaka position or Svabhava.
So am I, I must say. Well, I mean, it's a very good question. In fact, we had an entire workshop on that very problem. And what do the Madhyamika mean by conventional truth, right? So it depends a bit on where you look. If you go with Bhavaviveka and the Svatantrika interpretation of these texts, then it is there is no problem in saying there are systems of conventions, some of which are better than others, but none of which are ultimately true, right? So you can have a grading of convention, and then, okay, so how do you grade conventions? Well, for example, you might say that adopting one set of convention is more likely to lead to suffering in those using it than another one, right? So you use that. So you don't actually use any sort of ontic term and say one gets closer to the truth than another one, right? But of course, once you go prasangika, it gets considerably more intricate, because this svatantrika approach, that there could be something which is true at the conventional level but false at the ultimate level, is not available, right? So you have to say there is no svabhava even at the conventional level, right? So, I mean, it depends a bit. If you are happy of being a svatantrika, then you've got an answer to that, right? But if you aspire to full prasangika orthodoxy, then of course you have to go through a couple of more epicycles.
One quick comment,
yeah?
And one question.
Right?
Uh-huh. So they're both slightly on the historical,
mm-hmm,
side. I, there are probably many examples that would describe the relationship between Abhidharma and Madhyamaka,
mm-hmm,
which is a very complicated,
mm-hmm,
historical question.
Mm-hmm.
But I rather wish you hadn't taken the example of the five aggregates,
right,
which is not at all an Abhidharma category. You're talking about something which
comes from the early snakes, yeah.
Way back in Suttanta.
Right.
And it's only the same as if you've taken the Four Noble Truths.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's a bad example.
Right.
My question was common sense principle. Who are we talking about? Are we talking about Chandrakirti, or are we talking about the Madhyamaka Karika? I suppose my problem is that for me, Madhyamaka has a little bit too much svabhava in your analysis. it's reified. So who particularly are we talking about? Does Nagarjuna in fact assert that common sense principle? Do we have it really does? Because I wouldn't have thought so.
Well, I don't pretend to be able to channel Nagarjuna's intent. So that's a complicated question. If you take the line that Tsongkhapa has the faultless interpretation of Chandrakirti, and Chandrakirti has the faultless interpretation of Nagarjuna, and Nagarjuna has the faultless interpretation of the word of the Buddha, then you get the kind of system which I've tried to outline here, right? there are lots of ifs in here, right? But that's one strand of the tradition, right? And as I try to outline, if you go with a different set of commentaries, if you say go with the Bhavaveka, then these kind of problems don't arise, because you've got a, and that is actually why Svatantrika is quite actually popular with at least some present Madhyamaka philosophers, because it gives you a more flexible way of actually say ranking theories against each other without actually claiming that any one of them gets to the real deal, right? So what I've been trying to do here is to present the problem in the most extreme form, namely from the perspective of prasangika madhyamika, and see whether we can make sense of categories in that way, right? But I'm not saying that this is the only way of, I mean, it's obviously not the only way of reading Nagarjuna, but I think it's the most interesting one, because it's the most difficult one for answering this question. Because
Nagarjuna doesn't in fact say it.
So it doesn't say fact what?
It doesn't in fact state the common sense principle.
No.
That's my question.
No.
Obviously it's a statement of the Buddha, but the Buddha has given in the older texts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not understood in that way in the earlier literature. So this is Chandrakirti.
This is Chandrakirti interpreting Nagarjuna. Yeah.
Interpreting a statement of the Buddha and applying it to Nagarjuna.
Of course, I mean, from the Chandrakirti, these things wouldn't come apart, right? Because Nagarjuna has the faultless interpretation of what the Buddha meant. So, interpreting both at the same time. Yeah, thanks.
Well, I have two quick questions.
Uh-huh.
First, isn't the kind of denial that there's a master argument, or
mm-hmm,
mean that the whole Madhyamaka strategy of argumentation rests on an act of faith? I mean, it's a bit like the pessimistic meta-induction in philosophy of science, that every past scientific theory has been proved false,
mm-hmm,
is provably false, therefore current scientific theory is false.
Mm-hmm.
As a kind of, you know, I mean, surely the point, you know, surely a response to that could simply be, well, every past theory is you know, every false theory can be shown to be false.
Mm.
When a true theory comes along,
mm.
the true theory of categories comes along,
mm.
the Madhyamaka is not going to be able to refute it.
Mm.
So there's this kind of act of faith, I mean,
mm.
or it's kind of or begging the question, if you like.
Well, I don't know whether... Well, of course, what the Madhyamakas would claim, right, has always worked in the past, right? I mean, if that you believe in the success of their argument, they'd say, well, everything which has been has showed up to now didn't really hold water with Svabhava, or at least that's the way they interpret it, right? Now, act of faith, I mean, I'm not aware of any sort of passages where they worry about, is it going to work in the future, or so on, right? I mean, I think that the act of faith is here just the idea that this is the correct interpretation of the view of reality of an enlightened master, and therefore has to be... therefore the case you described won't happen, right?
Okay.
That's pretty close to getting to an act of faith.
That sounds like an act of faith.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is... but I don't think this is actually... I think it's a good point, but it's not a point they worry about.
No, but they ought to worry about it. Seems
well,
clear.
I mean, well, you ought to worry about it if you don't take this whole as a package of a philosophical position embedded in a religious context, right? Do you see what I mean?
No.
Right, because I mean, if you regard this as a purely philosophical methodology without actually looking at the way it is embedded in and is regarded as an interpretation of the words of a teacher with access to ultimate reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then it looks as if there's really, well, I mean, you don't know what's happened next. Perhaps you come up with a theory and there's lots of svabhava and we can't refute it, right? And I've got a problem. But if you actually see it in this context, you can understand why the traditional Madhyamaka commentaries didn't really worry about that.
Okay. My other question was, I'm worried about this appeal to the notion of common sense. I'm thinking of Dummett's very good article on common sense and common sense and physics,
mm-hmm.
where he basically argues that what we call common sense today is basically a residue of yesterday's physics.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no sharp distinction between, you know, common sense and scientific theory.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't the Madhyamaka appeal to two truths itself a categorical distinction? And isn't the whole point of Kumara's argument that there is no categorical distinction that ought to be appealed to?
Well, it depends, of course, again, how you interpret the two truth doctrine. And you might read it along the Sideritz line of saying that there's only one, right? So the ultimate truth is that there's only the conventional truth. In fact, in which case there is no categorical distinction because you only end up with systems of worldly conventions. So the idea would be then that there is no reality outside of the reality which is constituted by the set of conventions which sentient beings follow, right? So it's not as if sort of there's you've got two flavors. You've got the conventional and the ultimate flavor, and they somehow exist at the same time. And once you transcend the conventional, you reach the ultimate. In fact, according to this interpretation, which I think is a very good one actually, is that once you realize that the conventional is just conventional, that is the ultimate, right? In which case, there is no categorical distinction between two kinds of truth. It's just a different way of seeing the one kind of truth which they are. Namely, reading them in terms of svabhava or reading them in terms of merely conventionally imputed objects.
Yeah, and you're endorsing Sideritz.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the other one? You were going to say there's two ways. There may be three ways. Oh,
there are lots of ways of interpreting the theory of the two truths, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, another one is... I think it's the one you mentioned briefly before, is the idea that say, absolute truth is something which is beyond all concepts and inexpressible and something which actually can't phrase in language, right? So we just have to adopt a stance of silence there, something like that, right? So that would be another conceptualization of absolute truth as a realm which is not accessible to the intellect. And of course, there is a strong tendency in Buddhist philosophy of that reading too, right? I think the one that I've just been talking about has the advantage of, well, saying something to this problem and also has some other sort of neat philosophical advantages. What in particular I think it has the advantage of not turning Madhyamika into a form of Kantianism, where you say that, okay, that it's the transcendental absolute about we can say nothing, right? But it must be there as a postulate of reason, because otherwise there wouldn't be all this conventional stuff. And while I'm not saying that all Buddhist authors would necessarily disagree with this Kantian reading, I think it's not the strongest way of interpreting these texts.
And then there's some traditional commentators who will say that there's just the ultimate truth.
Yes.
Obviously no conventional.
Yes.
Quite a lot of them.
Yeah, sure.
I was just curious, in Shankara's system of thought, there's on the conventional level, he distinguishes between three types of illusion.
Uh-huh.
Sort of the day-to-day reality and the dreams, and the third one being like a square circle. I'm just curious that on in the Madhyamaka system of categorization on the conventional level, is there some parallel similar to that? Do they make how do they actually classify their categories, which later on they sort of reject? But how do they speak of categories on the conventional level?
Categorization. Yeah. Well. Well, I think the clearest example in the context of what I've been talking about is the discussion Tsongkhapa gives of this point in saying that, well, from the ultimate standpoint, there is no distinction in ontological terms between this kind of water and the kind of water which you find in a mirage, right? Because they're equally deceptive insofar as they're both seem to exist intrinsically with Svabhava by their inner nature, but in fact they lack that nature equally, right? However, from the conventional level, there is a distinction between this kind of water and the water in the mirage, because only this kind of water can actually have all the functional powers which are usually associated with it, so it can quench thirst and sustain life, and you can put a fish in it and so on, whereas the water in a mirage only satisfies the demands of one sensory modality, namely only sight, right? So this way you can draw and you can do something similar with dreams and so on, right? So it's important that at this point you can drive a wedge between the kind of day-to-day reality which most people would say is real and the kind of day-to-day reality which most people would say is unreal, without committing yourself to a stance where you would say there's any substantial svabhavata distinction between the water in the mirage and the water in the cup.
Johannes.
Okay. Yeah, just a suggestion concerning the common sense question of Janardhan. Of course, the idea of two kinds of reality doesn't start with Madhyamaka. It doesn't start with Nagarjuna. It is actually, as I tried to point out yesterday, that is part of Buddhism from the early Abhidharma days, even though the precise ways in which ultimate reality was conceived varied along the way. But all Buddhists for a long time agreed that common sense reality, in inverted commas for the time being, is not anything real. And as I pointed out yesterday, language was in a remarkable number of texts evoked as responsible for this reality which we go on in practical terms believing in. And we know this goes on for a while. There are some refinements and modifications, but until Dignaga, in Dignaga, language comes again back in full force to be responsible for the non-ultimate kind of reality. So common sense reality, if we try to see this from the point of view of a Buddhist of the time, I would propose is the kind of false reality we all submit to, partly or largely under the influence of language. Is that a proposal that you would swallow?
Yeah, I would. I think with that side of the equation, I have no problems with. Right. Of course, the interesting difference with the systems you described yesterday, so in particular the kind of meriological reductionism you find in Abhidharma when you say, okay, the whole is not real, but the parts are real, so the ultimate constituents are real. Well, that is, of course, where the great distinction comes in, because if you according to this Abhidharma system and a lot of other foundationalist systems, it's the things which exist dravyasat, which that's where the buck stops, right? This is which bears everything else, which this is the end of a chain of ontological dependence relations. So this is which bears everything else, or at least all the material world in this case, which we have around us. But if you then say there's the ultimate truth is the particles, and the conventional truth is a chariot, then of course that model changes beyond recognition when it comes to the absolute level once you get to Nagarjuna, because he certainly doesn't want to say,
because there the buck doesn't stop.
Exactly, the buck doesn't stop anywhere. So that it's
the conventional reality remains pretty much.
Exactly. So that's why I agree with you in saying that the view of conventional reality that is preserved in saying that, well, what we usually see is we're usually mistaken in most of the things we think about the world, and of course this is again then taken up also in Yogacara materials, that it's primarily a linguistically based construction of how we actually construe these conventionally constructed entities. But the point is, of course, that now the game has changed when it comes to asking, okay, so what is really real? Because for the Madhyamika, there isn't anything anymore really real like there is for the Abhidharmika, right? So you can still say it's a theory of two truths, but one of the truths is a completely different thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to know if in the Madhyamika Karika, whether Nagarjuna anticipates the argument
that is
also can function like swabhava. You know, like if you say that there's no swabhava,
mm-hmm.
that itself becomes like a swabhava of reality.
Oh, right.
Does he deal with this kind of argument?
If I understand you correctly, that's a very interesting problem. If I may just elaborate that a little bit. So the idea is that it seems to be that the absence of svabhavas, namely shunyata, has a lot of attributes which are usually associated with svabhava, for example, that it can't change and that it is independent of our conceptualization and so on, right? And this point is raised in an interesting way, again, in Chandrakirti, and I think it's commentary on chapter 15, if I'm not mistaken. But when he gives a long list of synonyms for shunyata, and then you find things like dharmata and so things which sound really sort of substantial, right? And so there are different. I mean, there are different ways of reacting to that. And well, apart from saying, okay, it's obviously contradictory, this system. The best way of getting out of, well, I mean, there are various ways of getting out of that bind, and Tsongkhapa has its own, and I won't go into that, but I think the best way is actually saying that, well, what is meant here is that, the crunch is of all these attributes, is that Chandrakirti says shunyata is not dependent on anything else, right? I mean, that's the crunch, because usually you say, okay, so it's, What constitutes things by svabhava is that they're not dependent, and everything is dependent in some way. So, but now he says emptiness is not dependent. So, what does he mean? Well, of course, there are different ways in which you can interpret independence. One thing of interpreting independence is, of course, saying it doesn't depend on anything at all, right? Now, that can't be it. But we could also interpret it by saying it doesn't depend on any particular thing, right? And any specific individual thing, right? Now, how does that work? Well, I think there is actually quite an interesting commentarial support for that interpretation, and this is when Chandrakirti talks about the person suffering from the eye disease with the floater. So he looks, I think, like the moon at an empty bowl and sees this full of hairs, right? So the point is now that then the Madhyamika comes along and tells them, look, there are no hairs in here, right? I mean, you've got it all wrong because you've got an eye disease, right? Now what Chandrakirti wants to say is, well, there is only point in, I mean, we only say the bowl is free of hairs because there is this guy with that illusion, right? But to somebody who does not have that superposition of has and something where it isn't, we don't make that statement. Similarly, the existence of emptiness is not something which is there in any way substantially or would be there if we weren't there. This is only something which exists as long as there are things exists on which people mistakenly superimpose svabhava, right? So for that extent, to that extent, emptiness is dependent. Sorry, it is dependent insofar as there have to be things to be empty, right? But it is independent insofar as there is no particular thing on which emptiness depends, right? So you don't need this for emptiness to exist, right? And I think that is one move which I like of getting out of that dilemma.
Because there's also the line that just by facing the argument as emptiness is empty,
mm-hmm.
you create a necessary regress.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fact that that would then cause a regress is no problem at all to the Madhyamika. You can simply say, well,
mm-hmm.
you can keep on saying emptiness is emptiness is emptiness,
mm-hmm.
keep on saying it, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But you altogether then create the need to think
mm-hmm.
that the question can be asked as to whether there is emptiness or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just another strategy.
That is of course the interesting problem which is raised at the very beginning of the Vigdhavyavatthani, right? When they say, okay, so what about your statement about that everything is empty? Isn't that empty too? And if it's empty too, doesn't that just mean it's just what you think, right? And it's interesting to see because that is. The kind of argumentative move which we even find today against sort of kinds of Rortian global anti-realism, right? Where we say, okay, so if you are an anti-realist, then how about the statement of anti-realism? Do you have to be anti-realist about that as well? And if you are anti-realist about anti-realism and I'm a realist, then I, of course, just say, well, I mean, this is just what you like to say, right? So it has no convincing power for me,
yeah.
right? So I mean, that argument, what you have to do there is, I think you have to some hefty argument about what the right kind of semantics is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I won't go into that now.
I'm supporting the Madhyamika position.
It's
quite the opposite of being the criticism that it's made out to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I just want to go back to another point. The thing about the faith thing kind of makes sense to me that, of course, that argument could come only if you have a kind of a historicist understanding of theory.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all surprising to think in the 20th century somebody would say what happens to a theory that's developed in the 21st century.
Mm.
But of course nobody in the first century was thinking that because you didn't have that structure of
sure.
thinking of time as that is. And it's only if you have that sense that we've had theories so far and then there'll be theories to come, would you be able to then think that the only way to treat this is as a matter of faith. But presumably that option was simply not available because that concept of temporality was not available then.
That's an interesting point, actually. Yeah, I mean that. Well, I mean it doesn't really help with the problem Jnanardhan was raising. It explains to us. It would explain
why
to us why the Madhyamika authors weren't troubled by that.
That's
but that's saying. Yeah. That's so. You mean they didn't have the idea of theoretical progress that where you know theories are superseded and so on and so on. Which I suppose makes a lot of sense if you look at the history of science in the cultures in which these materials developed.
I mean, nobody
yeah.
thinks at all about us occupying a moment in time, which is then going to be succeeded in the far future by other things, until very recently, even in Western thought. So it's only when that comes as a whole series of ways of questioning the legitimacy of our way of thinking is opened up. I think that's a peculiarly high modern movement.
Right, right.
Possibly tied up with understanding the whole notion of time and flows and so forth. The astonishing impact of H.G. Wells' time machine. Suddenly it opens up. Why is it, you know, we take it for granted? But why did it have that impact? It's precisely because there was that new way of thinking about time in relation to where we are.
I can offer support for that. I had a friend, in fact, who did a thesis on time travel in novels, and she found the idea comes in early in the 19th century, and she could only find one example in the whole world literature prior to that.
Where was that then?
That was done at Manchester.
No, sorry, where was the example? The first example, I mean.
The unlikely example was rabbinic.
Interesting,
I'd
right?
I have to tell the story.
Right.
Probably have
yeah, yeah, sure, okay. Yeah, yeah, okay, interesting.
But there is one example.
Okay.
Only one.
So that might be...
Okay. Okay, well that's...
If anybody knows any others, that would be very interesting.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
That's an interesting point.
The final thing I wanted to...
Go
ahead.
Well,
just... small point relating to Karaka, which you brought up. I mean, it's some time since I read the Gatharata Pariksha, but I'm sure there and elsewhere, Nagarjuna's argument crucially depends on the transformation of relationships on the sentence level or in inverted commas, a propositional level, if you like. Of relationships holding on the level of entities denotable by singular terms. So we are talking here a bit about suffixes, simply. And you have the gantr with an agent suffix, but you also have a finite verbal form, gacchati, say, with an agent suffix. And the noun-related gati cannot be identical with the verb-related gati, because the goer is not what he is, namely a goer, until or prior to an action of going. And the fact that the goer cannot be an agent of going prior to an action of going is really a pertinent argument in this context, in a way. So if it had been merely said that the fact that some gati exists, which is expressible by a verb, requires or entails that some gati exists that can be expressed by certain nominal expressions such as ganter or gamyamana, both derived from the verb root gam, then it would be difficult to suggest that these must be two different gatis. And that is where he uses the Karaka argument effectively. So two different gattis, one related to verbs and one related to nominal derivatives, but it's different if you say instead that any verb-related gatti depends on some noun-related gatti or vice versa.
Yes, and then what he tries to do is then argues that, okay, because there have to be both agents, and because, I mean, at least in this particular argument, he then argues that we have to split up motion into two parts, so we need two agents, right? And then I mean that's where he drives the wedge in, because then he says, well, this is unreasonable to assume that there's one action but two agents doing the action, right? And then you say, okay, perhaps it's unreasonable if you think it's a substance but not if it's two powers, and then right, okay, then the argument continues that way. Yes.
But my point is really that is illegal by Kuninian.
Sorry, what's illegal?
To have two agents, to have the agent expressed twice.
It's illegal insofar as you can't make sense of it on the semantic level, or it's forbidden by the grammatical structure. Sorry? Yes. No, I'm aware of that.
In the Pauline system, you can only express the agent once.
Right. So what would happen to the phrases he discussed there? Would they then turn out to be unacceptable or ungrammatical?
He's playing around with the Karaka system.
Yeah, but is he playing in such a way that it would not have been acceptable to Panini? Or would he have said that then the expression he analyzes is actually ungrammatical?
No, I'm not sure if you can say Ganta Chati, because it's already expressed. There is a ruling related to the Karaka
system.
Anabhihite is not already expressed.
Right.
So I suppose, as so many other things, Nagarjuna says you can say it, but are you actually saying anything when you say it?
Yes, of course. The question is, because what the Karaka theory does, it tells you something about what's supposedly happening at the semantic level, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then that's the question, is whether what's happening there is coherent.
The question is it merely pleonistic to say the goer goes, or is there a violation?
Yes, is there a problem at the semantic level, right? Or are you just conveying the same information twice?
what I meant to say is that I think he's directly playing on the fact that this isn't somehow acceptable from any usage, and
right.
He's sort of playing the map as two possibilities that are mutually exclusive.
Right, right, okay.
It's about 2 or 3 minutes to lunch, I think.
Everybody's happy.
Further questions?
Everybody's happy.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you.